Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Episode 2 of The Great Scientists, a book by John Farnham, a 2000 and something or other, six book. It's covering the great scientists. We've done the first ancient scientists. This is Euclid, Archimedes, Ptolemy, and Hipparchus. These are the the scientists which have sort of made a lasting impression into the modern age. And we're now going to look at the medieval Arab scientists, which are probably worthwhile looking at. And of course, as always, the aim of this is for, cognitive stuff to learn how to read more interestingly and more fluently by having heaps and heaps of practice. Things improve a little bit. Now, previously, I was wanting to combine exercise, bike, and reading. It was a bit unworkable. So hopefully this will go more smoothly. Okay, the introduction paragraph is, during the period known in Europe as the Dark Ages, in the Middle East, became the intellectual hub of the world, and a string of brilliant Arab scientists sowed the seeds that would later be reaped in the scientific revolution of the 17th century. So this is interesting. We'll just see what the byline is for the ancients. No, I think the medieval scientists are all lumped together. That's right. So the individuals got an individual byline. These are lumped together, but nonetheless, very interesting. And I have to beg forgiveness for not pronouncing the names correctly. Al-Khawarizmi gave us our number system and algebra. Ibn Sina, Advencia, that's the Latin name of it, Advencia, wrote the greatest book on medicine for 1,000 years. And Al-Biruni's pioneering works included comparisons of the speed of light and sound. This great flowering of Arab science began in what is sometimes called the Golden Age of Islam, the time when the consolidating influence of Islamic religion saw Arab Muslims begin to build an empire that was to stretch across the Middle East and across North Africa into Spain. At the heart of this Islamic world lay the city of Baghdad, where the caliphs ruled. The rule of the caliphs reached zenith under Abbasid dynasty, and in particular in the reign of Caliph Harun al-Rashid, the son of Al-Ma'mun. I think Al-Ma'mun is actually something to do with I remember. Harun al-Rashid, who became a caliph in AD 786, has become famous for the fictional role given to him in that 1001 Nights. The Disney movie is called Aladdin, okay. Which has been partially written in his reign. But his reign marked the beginning of an astonishing flowering of culture in Baghdad. The nature of Islam meant that scholarship was treasured, and Baghdad became a centre of unrivaled intellectual activity in all fields, including science, technology, poetry, and philosophy. The Arab scholars saw no distinction between these branches of thought, and many would have study mathematics or write poetry with equal zeal. And we should also point out that a lot of the scientific works, from even including the time of Newton, had a poem at the start, poem and illustrations. So as we have sort of documentaries with sweeping shots and music for popular science, so there was not sort of the sort of separation of popular science and rigorous professional science as it was there. And so this overlap, which they say here, oh, this is amazing, they did it, was really part of science in general. And I also think that there's the idea that scientists are pure scientists, but I think there's a little bit of philosopher and a bit of ethicist in the scientists. Under the caliphate of Harun al-Sun al-Ma'mun, from 813 on, Baghdad drew scholars from far and wide to work in the House of Wisdom, created by the caliph about 820. The House of Wisdom was a mixture of library, research institute, and university. Indeed, it was the first great library since the Library of Alexandria had been destroyed, possibly in the 1st century BC. One of the House of Wisdom scholars' tasks was to translate the great works of the Greek thinkers, and it's largely thought the Greek ideas were preserved throughout the Dark Ages. But the scholars also did practical research, establishing the world's first proper astronomical observatory, for instance. They also developed an astrolabe, one of the most influential scientific instruments of all time, allowing the astronomers to measure the position of stars with unparalleled accuracy. In medicine, they improved diets, made the first serious studies of drugs, and advanced surgery hugely. Indeed, Muslim scholars of the Golden Age made more important and original contributions to mathematics, astronomy, and medicine and chemistry. It is interesting. I haven't got my head what exactly an astrolabe is. I know it sort of allows you to get a line or a position on a star. Okay, when Alamut died in 833, the central role of influence of Baghdad began to wane, but in its place, energetic pockets of scholarships began to spring up throughout the Islamic world. The great al-Burundi lived under the patronage of the Ghaznavid caliphs in the east, while Avincia under the Samarid caliphs in Bukhara, whatever that means. Al-Khawarizmi, who's that first person? Very little is known about the life of al-Khawarizmi, and much of his life story seems to be pure conjecture. It sort of tends to do. It seems likely that he was born in what is now Uzbekistan, south of the Aral Sea in Central Asia. Some scholars say his father was Zoroastrian, and he was brought up in the ancient faith, which dates back to the time of ancient Sumeria. I really want to understand Zarathustra and Zoroastrians. Others say this is completely misinterpreted the records. All we do know is al-Khawarizmi was born about 786. Okay, now, which is interesting about how they actually put this forward. The year Harun al-Rashid came to power, and when this Harun's son al-Mawaz set up a house of wisdom, al-Khawarizmi was there studying. One of the greatest contributions was to provide a comprehensive guide to the Hindu numbering system, which originated in India around 500 AD. And this system, later called the Arab system, because it came to Europe from al-Khawarizmi, that became the basis of our modern numbers. So this is the idea of place value, that the number means something, a limited number, but where it is placed relative to the decimal point is important, though a decimal point didn't come in. The Arab system, clearly explained by al-Khawarizmi in his book on Hindu numerals, uses only 10 digits, 0 to 9, to give every single number from 0 up to the biggest number imaginable. The value is given to each digit very simply according to its position, i.e. place value. So the 1 in 100 is 10 times 1, 10 times the 1, so the 1 in 100 is 10 times the 1 in the 10, and 10 times the 1, and 100 times the 1 in the 1, okay. That's really poor. That is so poorly expressed. It was a huge advance on the previous numbering system, which became incredibly cumbersome with any large numbers. Roman numbering system, for instance, needed 7 digits to give a number as small as, for example, 38. Arabic numbers can give a very large numbers quite compactly. 7 digits Arabic numerals can, of course, do anything up to 10 million. What's more, by standardizing units, Arab numerals became made multiplication, division, and every other form of mathematics calculation much, much simpler. Not surprisingly, when it reached Europe, it was quickly caught on, and since then, around the world, has become known as a truly global language. With the numbers, Europe gained another word, algorithm, for a logical step in a mathematical process based on the spelling of Al-Khazim's name in the Latin title of his book, Algorithmi de Numero Indorum. So Al-Khazim, algorithm. Inventing algebra. The introduction of Arab numerals owed something to Hindu mathematics. Al-Khazimi's other major contribution was much more his own work. This, too, introduced a word into our language known as algebra, and a whole new branch of mathematics. And what is interesting is that in developing algebra, Al-Khazimi had something eminently practical in mind, not just abstract theory. In his introduction to the book in which he describes algebra, he says the aim of his work with what is easiest and most useful in mathematics is such that men constantly require in cases of inheritance, legacies, partitions, lawsuits, trade, and all their dealings with one another, or when measuring lands, digging canals, or making geometrical calculations. Although we now associate algebra entirely with the idea of symbols replacing unknowns of numbers and calculations, Al-Khazimi did not actually use symbols, which is, has to be Descartes. Descartes is absolutely brilliant. The rounded Descartes began to do that one. René, for he wrote everything out in full words. It was only a way of handling equations that created algebra. Okay, so there's another thing on Ibn Sina and Al-Burundi. So these are things. So what's going to happen is that we're going to have the main article and side articles to cover co-workers. Completing and balancing. In his work in algebra, Al-Khazimi worked with what we now call linear equations. That is, equations that involve only units without squared figures, and quadratic equations which involve squares and square roots. His great breakthrough was to reduce every equation to the simplest possible form by a combination of two processes, algebra and al-maqalaba. Algebra means completion and involves simply taking away all negative terms using modern symbols. Algebra means simplifying x squared equals 40x minus x, 4x squared to 5x squared equals 40x. Al-maqalaba means balancing, involves reducing all the positive terms to their simplest form. Alqua introduces, for instance, 50 plus 3x plus x squared equals 29 plus 10x to just 21 plus x squared equals 7x. I just don't quite see the difference between it. I don't think they really understand what's going on. In this way, he reduced every equation to six simple standard forms and then showed a method of solving each. He went on to provide geometrical proofs of each of his methods. Some scholars say that these prove he must have read Euclid's geometry, especially as some of his colleagues in the House of Wisdom had translated Euclid's The Elements. Others say they are so markedly different from Euclid that his geometry came from elsewhere. In developing algebra, Al-Khazimi built on the work of Hindu mathematicians such as Brahmagupta, but it was Al-Khazimi who turned it into a simple all-embracing system, and he was rightly dubbed the father of algebra. The very word algebra comes from the title of his book, okay? Al-Kita al-Motska fi Hizaba Algebra Wazma Kubla, the compendious book of calculating by completion and balancing. I don't quite understand the difference between completion and balancing. The world and the stars. Like all the Arab scholars, Al-Khazimi had interest beyond mathematics. Apart from his books on numbers and algebra, he wrote a third major book on geography called Kitlab sur al-Ard, the image of the earth, and reintroduced some of Ptolemy's ideas and described positions through longitude and latitude, which he wrote geography, but improved on their accuracy, particularly for the length of the Mediterranean Sea and the locations of cities in Asia and Africa. Al-Khwarizmi also helped create a map of the world for Caliph al-Mum and got involved in a project to measure the circumference of the Earth by measuring the length of a degree of longitude through the plain of Sinjar in Iraq. Scholars in this part of the world had long moved beyond the idea the world is flat. At some time of his life, Al-Khwarizmi worked on astronomical problems too. He compiled astronomical tables. Hi, Cecilia. And develops tables of science for helping calculate the positions of stars. Al-Khwarizmi's work took perhaps 3 centuries to reach Western Europe, and probably became via Moorish Spain. But when it did arrive, its impact was lasting. Arabic numbers and algebra are central to our lives today. And that's what you see here. So there's Al-Khwarizmi, now Ibn Sina, the Vincia, which is, you know, one of the two satellite people. Born in Bukhara in 980, so he's a long time after Al-Khwarizmi. Ibn Sina, sometimes known by the Latin name Avincia, was something of a prodigy. It's said that by the age of 10 he knew not just the Quran but most of the Arab poetry by heart, and by the age of 16 had become a qualified physician. His skills as a physician became almost legendary, and though the turbulent politics of the time kept him permanently unsettled, he was a physician to a succession of princes and caliphs. It's really interesting that being a physician was a major thing. That's that is often how these people got along. I think Bruno was, you know, a Giovanni Bruno was a physician. But he also became the most famous philosopher, scholar, mathematician, astronomer of his age, and wrote books on a huge range of scientific topics, a vast encyclopedia, the first ever written, and even wrote short poems, one of which goes, quote, "Up on the earth's centre through the seventh gate arose, and on the throne of Saturn sat, and many a knot unravelled by the road, but not the master knot of human fate." Okay, so I imagine that. He's unraveling ideas, but I don't know what's going to happen to humanity. Ibn Sina made a number of key astronomical observations, devised a vernier scale to help readings more precise, and made a string of key contributions to physics, such as identifying different forms of energy, heat, light, and mechanical, and the idea of a force. So that's very interesting to me, because now I think we can say that Newton... these ideas were around, but Newton just put them together. Whereas Newton put them into formula form, he had them here. He noted that if light consists of a stream of particles, then its speed must be finite. Mathematical techniques of casting out nines, used to verify squares and cubes, was also attributed to Sina. So I really want to know what casting out nines is. Yet his fame is above all based on his book, Al-Quran fi al-Tib, The Canon of Medicine. This vast volume, consisting of over 1 million words, surveyed the entire field of medical knowledge from ancient times up to the most up-to-date Muslim techniques. His comprehensive, systematic approach meant that once it was translated into Latin in the 12th century, it became the standard medical textbook in Europe for the next 600 years, up to 1800. Besides bringing together existing knowledge, the canon contains some of Ibn Sina's own insights. He was the first to recognize, for instance, tuberculosis and phthisis are contagious, that diseases can be spread through soil and water, and a person's emotions can affect their state of physical health. He was the first to describe meningitis and realized that nerves transmit pain. His book, he contained descriptions of 760 drugs, and so became a doctor's Bible for centuries to come, which is really interesting. I suppose he was Dr. Google back then, but it's interesting there. So in physics, he's probably above Newton as far as I call. Al-Biruni, the Persian scholar that lived around the same time as Ibn Sina, and the two are known to have corresponded. He had a special gift for languages and is said to have spoken Turkish, Persian, Sanskrit, Hebrew, Syriac, besides his native Arabic. He was patronized by Ghazanvid Caliph Mahmud, who took Alberindi with him and went on his campaigns in India. Oh my God, Father. This is probably how Alberindi learned the languages. Certainly his most famous book, Kitab al-Hindi, A Book of India, came out of the travels. Although he is not known for any particular scientific advance, his contribution remains a spectrum. He was first to firmly establish trigonometry as a branch of mathematics. He wrote treatises on the effects of drugs and medicine. He pioneered the idea that light travels faster than sound. He promoted the idea that the earth rotates around its axis. He made many accurate calculations of latitude and longitude and suggested, contrary to received opinion at the time, that Africa might not stretch south forever. He also accurately measured the density of 18 precious stones and metals and noted that flowers have 3, 4, 5, 6 or 8 petals, but never 7 or 9. It's interesting to do that. That's really based on quantum mechanics. Now we move up to Leonardo da Vinci. Okay, that's a bit of a gap, the Arab ones. And he's from 1452 to 1519. So, though he was supposed to be an old man, let's work this out. I suppose he was 67. It seems quite young to me. Poland, although he is best known for his masterful paintings such as the Mona Lisa, Leonardo da Vinci, 1452-1519, is revealed as a remarkable scientist by his notebooks, perhaps the first great scientist of the modern age. I think you really have to include Leonardo da Vinci because he's got so much theme. We know that Leonardo da Vinci was a remarkable scientist only from the surviving pages of his notebooks. There are thousands of these pages, each packed with Leonardo's extraordinary drawings and writings on a huge range of subjects, from geology, anatomy, astronomy, gravity, flight, optics, and much, much more. Often Leonardo flits from one topic to another on a single page. It's interesting that he wrote notebooks, but he never referred to, you know, we don't know whether he referred to them. Most famous of all Leonardo's inventions within the pages are sketches of notes for scores of machines and devices, some just tentative ideas, some fully worked out in detailed drawings. What is astonishing is not just the sheer range of problems that Leonardo da Vinci put his mind to, from war machines to water supply, but just how many of his ideas are almost unnervingly ahead of his time. Helicopters, tanks, cars, aeroplanes, bikes, parachutes all appear in Leonardo's pages 500 years before they became a reality. It seems unlikely, though, that Leonardo tried out many of these amazing ideas. It seems unlikely, too, that anyone else even knew about them except the few who required pages of the notebooks down the ages. The same goes for his scientific writings. Leonardo's tiny writing, often written backwards in mirror form, probably to make it easier to write with the left hand, is difficult to decipher. But as a result of the scholars' studies of Leonardo's scientific writings, he has emerged as one of the finest scientific minds in history. His notes on subjects of anatomy to astronomy reveal him to have be almost as far ahead of his time in science as he is in inventions. In his geology in particular, Leonardo was discussing sediment, strata, fossils and the age of the earth in a way that anticipated the great debates of the 19th century. Over 300 years later, even more significantly, that's right, he's well before, you know, the church and all that sort of thing, even before, so it's 80 years after he died, Bruno got burnt. Even more significantly, Leonardo's great emphasis on first-hand observations foreshadowed the scientific approach that was able to have such an impact on centuries later. He wrote, "Things of the mind left untested by senses are useless." That's pretty interesting. Yet, for whatever reason, Leonardo kept his thoughts to himself. No one knows exactly why he wrote the notebooks. Obviously not to refer to them, it's just almost impulsiveness. Most people believe his plan was eventually to publish them as a book. I don't think so. I can well imagine if you are just in an age of complete insanity, you tend to write your own ideas. But by keeping quiet about his ideas, he ensured that all his extraordinary insights he actually had little impact on the progress of science. And this is best known today as an artist. One can only speculate how different things might have been if his ideas became known. Well, childhood in Vinci. Leonardo was born 15th of April, 1452, in the little Tuscan town of Vinci. His mother was a 16-year-old servant called Caterina, while his father was a local notary solicitor called Sepero. After birth, Sepero married a local heiress called Albira, while Caterina was quickly married off to a local cowherd, leaving the baby in Sepero's care. Sepero and his new wife had little time for the infant, who was looked after mainly by his grandparents and his uncle Francesco, which is really interesting. A lot of these geniuses don't have, if you look at Newton, that happened to Newton as well. They don't have a good maternal bracket thing. So it's interesting what you give, they compensate for. You know, if they're deficient, they compensate for, and sort of almost randomly it can actually grow forward. Even as a child, Leonardo proved to be an extraordinarily gifted. He learned to play the lyre and sing beautifully, as adept as horse riding, and foreshadowed a remarkable aptitude for mathematics. He would often go wandering through the countryside by himself around Vinci, always carrying a notebook to make his ready, striking sketches of plants and animals. Leonardo, now the interesting thing is that books and binding, the book binding and printing must have started up earlier to provide notebooks. If you go back further, people didn't have just notebooks. Leonardo in Florence. When his grandfather died in 1468, the family moved to Florence. Florence at the time was the most exciting creative city in Europe. Dominating it all was Bocelli's spectacular new cathedral dome. But now, below the teeming streets, were scores of workshops and studios turning out a stream of brilliant art, such as Ghiberti's Baptistry doors and Dante's Statue of David. Leonardo's father was by now well aware of his son's artistic talents and sent him to study in the studio of Andrea Verrocchio, his theme, then the most famous sculptor and painter and goldsmith in Florence. Leonardo was a fast learner and soon surpassed his master in skill, causing Verrocchio, legend has it, to give up painting in despair. At this time, he cut a dashing figure around town wearing overly short pink stocking breeches. People have speculated about his sexuality, and he seems never to have had any interest in women, writing in his notebooks, quote, "The act of procreation is anything that has anything relation to it. It's so disgusting that human beings will soon die out if there were no pretty faces and sensuous disposition," or whatever it is. Whatever the truth, his disinterest in personal relationship left plenty of time for him to work on his ideas and develop his art. We would probably call him autistic now, wouldn't they? Leonardo in Milan. In 1480, he received his first great art commission from Lorenzo the Magnificent, the head of Florence's ruling family, the Medicis. Lorenzo began work on his painting, The Adoration of the Magi, but before long abandoned it to write to Livizio Sforza, the Duke of Milan, advertising his services, not primarily as a painter and a sculptor, but as a military engineer. And in his letter of introduction, he talked about his ability to make armoured cars, siege engines, portable assault bridges, and catapults. Livizio ignored this letter, but later summoned Leonardo to Milan, where he stayed 17 years until the French captured the city in 1499, and Livizio fled. Throughout his time in Milan, Leonardo was kept busy painting, staging court festivals, and advising on architecture, fortification, drains, water supply, and anything else of technical nature. His greatest achievement in Milan was the painting of the Last Supper. What a fantastic painting. In 1495 to 98, considered by some the finest painting ever. His most consuming project, though, was a giant bronze statue of Livizio on horseback. This became the most celebrated of Leonardo's many overambitious failures. And when he met Michelangelo, the great sculptor mocked him for it. And recognized the two artists embarked on a duel by paint. Both were to paint a giant mural of a battle scene. Leonardo began painting the Battle of Agnihari and Michelangelo, the Battle of Cassari. Neither artist finished their work, but it was preparing for this painting that Leonardo did much of his anatomical research. Spending time in Florence at the Santa Maria Nova Hospital studying injuries and also dissecting corpses. He later planned to publish his anatomical manuscript in 1510, but it came to nothing. Leonardo on the move. From 1500 on, the political instability of the times meant that Leonardo was constantly on the move between Florence, Venice, Rome, and other Italian cities, never staying more than a year in each. For a few years, he was in the service of the ruthless Cesare Borgia. He travelled across Caesar's land, surveying them with many techniques that anticipated modern cartography. In 1503, Leonardo surveyed and planned a route for the canal to connect Florence to the city. In 1505, at about the time he was losing interest in the Battle of Agari, the painting of the famous Mona Lisa, he wrote in a book about the flight of birds, and over the next few years he filled his notebooks with ideas of flying machines, including the helicopter and parachute. By the time he was 60, Leonardo was beginning to tire of having to move all the time. He accepted gift rooms of the Vatican in Rome in 1513 and stayed there for 3 years, hoping to commission. But all the projects were going to others, such as Michelangelo and Bratti. Leonardo probably worked for a while as a consultant on the Pope's plan to reclaim the Pontine marshes, but there was not much else. He also may have spent time investigating optical puzzles and experimenting with flight. So, in 1516, the aging artist accepted an invitation from King Francis I of France and left Italy for good. Leonardo in France. This is really rather sad. In France, Leonardo took up residence in the house Clou, provided by Francois, and settled down to work on his notebooks. By this time, he had a stroke, and his right hand was partially paralyzed, so work was slow. Fortunately, the king did not expect any substantial work from him. All Leonardo had to do was produce plans for festivals and plays and provide designs of toys such as the mechanical lion that opened to reveal Lilies and the Beast. Indeed, the French king was a great admirer of Leonardo and was generally pleased to have him about. Poor Leonardo was constantly interrupted by visits from the well-meaning Francois, who walked through a tunnel connected his Amboise, the palace, Amboise Palace to Leonardo's house. His chateau, designed by Leonardo da Vinci, is a complete gawk. Leonardo died quietly at Clou on the 23rd of April, 1519, and was buried in a nearby church of St. Florentin. The church is now destroyed in the French Revolution. Leonardo's remains were lost. Oh dear. His young companion, Francesco Melzi, was grief-stricken and stayed in the house for months before the finally packing up of all Leonardo's belongings, including 13,000 priceless pages of his notes, and heading off in a cart to Vaprio in Italy. There the notes remained in his care until he died and left them to his son, Osoro. Osoro took no interest in Leonardo's notes, stuffing them in notebooks in the cupboard in the attic and giving away others. A word spread about the notebooks to collectors descended on Vaprio, taking bits away, often ripping pages out, scattering Leonardo's work. Today, the pages are distributed amongst museums and private collections, including the famous Codex Leicester, bought by Microsoft founder Bill Gates in 1994 for $30 million. Of the original pages, almost half have been lost. Okay, so this is all here. Leonardo's notebooks. Leonardo's flying machines. This is a subtext. So this is a subtext which, for the Arab person, whatever his name was, he had different Alcina, Alvencia, and Alburundi. This is a bit more interesting. This is a detail. Leonardo's notebooks reveal an astonishing range of invention: clocks, printing presses, drills, boats, driving suits, cars, battle tanks. Yet perhaps the most astonishing are his flying machines. At the heart of Leonardo's thinking was the belief that human and animal bodies are simply organic machines. This belief underpinned many of his investigations into anatomy and also inspired his inventions. It was looking at birds flying that convinced Leonardo that flying machine was feasible. A bird is simply an instrument functioning according to the laws of nature, he wrote, in which case a man can recreate that instrument. His first design of flying machines depended on flapping wings are known as orthopters. In 1487, he made a drawing of a orthopter, which means a bird copter, in which a pilot lay flat in the frame and his feet and stirrups pedaling to make the wings flap. A few years later, he came up with a design for an orthopter with the rudders and elevators to give first control flight, a remarkably advanced idea. Orthopters would never have worked because human power simply isn't great enough. Leonardo may have realized this himself because he soon dropped the idea of flapping wings in order to work on gliders. To further his knowledge of wings and airflow, Leonardo studied birds and falling leaves, and doing so invented the world's first aerometer to measure wind speed. 10 years before he died, he drew up a design for a glider that had a genuine control system, not unlike modern hang gliders. Leonardo wrote, "This man will move to the right side as he bends his right arm and extends his left, and he will then move to the right to left by changing the position of his arms." Recently, experts have built the machine based exactly on the design, using only materials that would have been available to Leonardo, and proved that not only would it have been able to fly, but could be controlled in flight, something not achieved until Wright Brothers' famous flight in 1903. Leonardo realized that wings are not the only way of flying. He designed a helicopter to climb vertically into the air, carrying men on the platform beneath it. Unlike modern helicopters, it did not have rotor blades, but a spiral screw designed to lift up through the air. Helicopter toys and rotors had actually been around for centuries, but Leonardo's was the first, and perhaps the last, for another 500 years to try a design of one for lifting people. Leonardo clearly grasped that air had enough substance to support aerofoil shapes and designed machines based on a boat with oars, which the pilot rowed through the air. Although it clearly would not work, he had at least recognized the principle that was the lead propellers and rotors a century later. So it's oars. And this is the special Something Rather Man. Leonardo's Anatomy, this is the Something Rather Man. Oh, famous picture of this man with four arms and a square and a circle. Leonardo's Anatomy. It's based on his work on anatomy that Leonardo had the most lasting impact in the progress of science. At the time when most physicians were learning about the human body from a second century physician Galen, Leonardo dissected corpses to find things out for himself. He was not the only one to do this, as it was expected that artists should know their anatomy. At around the same time that Leonardo was in Florence, for instance, Florentine painter called Antonio Benivie wrote a treatise based on his own dissections. Yet Leonardo went much further in his analysis, dissecting over 30 human corpses personally and constructing many experiments to see how the parts of the body work. He also dissected bears, cows, frogs, monkeys, and birds to compare their anatomy with that of humans. Leonardo's superlative skill in illustration and his obsession with accuracy made his anatomical drawings the finest in the world has ever seen. In order to display the layers of the body, he developed a drawing technique of cross sections that is still used today. He also developed remarkable three-dimensional arrays of muscles and organs from different perspectives, a technique that has only come to its own in the computer age. One of Leonardo's special interests was the eye, and he was fascinated by how the eye and brain worked together. He was probably the first autonomous ever to see the optic nerve leaves the back of the eye and connects to the brain. He is probably the first to realize how nerves link the brain to the muscles. And there is no such thing as idea in Galen's anatomy. How we've also said that someone else in the Arab thing was a nerve discoverer. It's perhaps the study of muscles where Leonardo's bend of artistry and scientific analysis is best seen. He observed exactly what happens to muscles when they move the body in different ways, how muscles in the face made people smile or frown, and much more. It's a very, I suppose, very interesting. This is the this famous picture. I really wish there's a picture on it. So I'm going to stop now and just see how the how my family is going. Then we've got Nick Copernicus. Very interesting thing. Nick Copernicus. I don't know, Vesalius and Galileo. I don't know how many we'll do on that one. It's interesting, Nick Copernicus, I suppose. It's Kepler, which is the interesting person behind it. And, yeah, I don't know. I've not heard of Vesalius before. So I'll just take a break now and read after this. Nicholas Copernicus. Nicholas Copernicus, from 1473 to 1543. So just let's check how that overlaps with Leonardo. So he's about 20 to 30 years shifted from Leonardo da Vinci. At the time Copernicus was born, Europe was beginning to feel the effects of the Renaissance. Classical ideas and texts were appearing in Europe from the Arab world. Thinkers were beginning to add to them ideas of their own. So at this time, Roman scholar Ptolemy's model of how the universe worked, described in the book Almagest the Greatest, was still considered correct. In this model, the Earth was still and fixed in the centre of the universe. Around the Earth were a series of invisible concentric spherical crystal shells in which the sun, moon, planets, stars revolved in perfect circles once the heavenly body in each, except the heavenly body in each, except the stars. What I have to say is that it was Aristotle who, the sphere was a perfect, a heavenly object. And so they have to be spheres, don't they? Unfortunately for this model, actual observations showed that only the stars appeared to move in perfect circles. To account for this, Ptolemy suggests two main mechanisms, epicycles and equants. These explains, I wonder what equants are, epicycles? I don't know what equants are, distance. This explained the apparent motion of the planets while still keeping the idea of perfect circles. Epicycles were basically tiny circular motions inside each sphere, or wheels within wheels. Equants, allow the circles of the moon and planets to be slightly offset and turn around different points, called equant points, rather than all turning around to the exact centre of the Earth. Okay, yeah, so I do understand equants. Equants are the difference. This view of the universe as a series of nested crystal spheres turning around the Earth pretty much worked in that it allowed astronomers to predict accurately the motions of the Sun, Moon, planets then known as Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter and Saturn. But there were problems. In 1490, when Copernicus was in his 20s, a German astronomer, Johannes Müller, better known by his Latin name Regiomontanus, published a summary of Ptolemy's Almagest, along with a critical commentary called The Epitome. In The Epitome, Geomantus pointed out that one of the problems of the Ptolemaic system is that if a circle of the moon is offset as the system says it is, it should be greater, get larger or smaller as it moves closer to the Earth and further away, yet it clearly doesn't. Isn't that amazing? Well, that's an interesting thing. So it's going in a circle. Oh, right, yeah, so the moon should actually change shape as it moves around. Another problem with the Ptolemaic system, as far as the young priest Copernicus was concerned, was that it seemed too elaborate and intricate. Surely God would have created something more simple and more elegant. All these complications would disappear. Copernicus realized that the sun was the center and the earth revolves around it along with the other planets. The only difficulty was how to account for the fact that the moon turned around the earth. Now, this is interesting. So Copernicus is perfect circles as well. Although this heliocentric sun-centered system had a great advantage of the actually being true, it took more than a century for his idea to be widely known, and even longer for it to be widely accepted. Michelangelo Copernic. Copernicus was born in Turin, Turin on the Vistula River in northern Poland, on 19th of February, 1473. His real name was Michael Copernic, and it was only later in his life that he adopted the Latin version of his name, Nicholas Copernicus. His father, well-to-do merchant, died when he was about 10, and so he was brought up by an uncle Lucas was long dead, soon Bishop of Weimar. His uncle saw that he had a general education, typical of those destined for a career in the church. Really interesting, the dads always tend to die a lot. At the age of 20, Copernicus went to the University of Krakow to study his liberal arts, including astrology and astronomy. Then, 5 years later, he went on to study at Bologna in Italy, where he lodged for a while in the house of the distinguished astronomer and astrologer Farnese. It was Farnese who really inspired Copernicus' interest in the star and introduced him to Roger Manta's Epitome, which is the criticism. In 1497, Copernicus observed the eclipse of the moon in Bologna. By the time Copernicus had finished his doctorate in canon law in 1503, he was well grounded in astronomy and already beginning to develop his ideas about the heliocentric universe. His uncle arranged for him to become canon of Fronburg Cathedral in Poland, a post which allowed him plenty of free time for both studying and astronomy and pursuing various other tasks. He worked for the community as a doctor, for instance, and developed a plan for reforming currency. In 1519, he was pressed into military service to command the defense of the castle of Allenstein against the invading Teutonic Knights. What the fuck is going on, Teutonic Knights? The great idea. In the meantime, he took advantage of his position in the cathedral to consolidate his ideas. Most of his astronomy, I wonder if the Teutonics were also Christians, was entirely on paper and in his head, but sometimes he climbed the cathedral tower at Fromberg, and so at Ansteg and Hasberg to gaze at the night sky. Unlike later scientists, Copernicus had no interest in verifying his ideas by observation or experiment, which is really interesting. In 1514, Copernicus published a little handwritten book for his friends called Commentarialis. It gave the first outline of the revolutionary theory around in Commentarialis. Copernicus included not just the idea that the Earth moved around the Sun, that the stars were very, very far away, but the suggestion that this arrangement explains a number of phenomena such as retrograde motion and planets. Ptolemy had explained retrograde motion, in fact, that the planets appear to look back on themselves every now and then by means of complicated epicycles. But if it is accepted the Earth is moving around the Sun and the planets, with the planets, no such elaborate explanation is needed. Retrograde motion is simply due to the changing views of the planet Earth. Copernicus also suggested in Commentarialis that the same is taken for each planet to complete its cycle through the night sky might increase the further it was from the Sun. Mercury cycles take 88 days, which makes it the nearest planet to the Sun. Venus, 225. Earth, 1 year. Mars, 1.9 years. Jupiter, 12 years. Saturn, 30 years. It was thus easy for Copernicus to work out the order of the planets. Now, this is Kepler. It's Kepler. You increase the length of your orbit by your orbital distance, obviously, 2 pi r squared, 2 pi r for the distance, as r increases, as r, then you multiply by an extra square root of r. Very simple. Keeping quiet, Copernicus made it clear in his little book that he was planning a major work to expand the theory in full, writing here, for the sake of brevity, I have thought it desirable to omit the mathematical demonstrations intended in my larger work. This larger work, the famous De Revolutionibus Aurum Coelestium, The Revolutions of Heavenly Spheres, was to be published in a further 26 years, which by Titanic Commodus was on his deathbed. This delay is perhaps due to his religious view of the universe of the time. Copernicus may have thought it simply too dangerous to publicize this idea. Others suggest Copernicus delayed because he had not developed his idea and proof sufficiently. Daring young man. Whatever the truth, a final spur Copernicus needed was to finish his great book came from acquired from disciple of George von Locken, known as Rheticus, a young professor of mathematics from Wittenberg. Rheticus came to Fromberg to learn about Copernicus's idea. When he realized their importance, he was determined that Copernicus should publish his work. In 1540, Rheticus published a curtain raiser called Narrato Prima De Libertas Revolutionis Copernici, first account of the revolutionary book of Copernicus. who has summarized Copernicus's main ideas that the Earth moves around the Sun. This seems to have done the trick. Copernicus wrote to a friend in 9th of June 1541 that he had finally overcome Copernicus's reluctance to release his volume for publication. By August that year, De Revolutionibus Orbitum Scholastrum was ready. Copernicus undertook to see it printed and took it to Johann Petrus, the best printer in Nuremberg. Unable to see the printing through personally, Copernicus deputed the task to Lutheran minister called Osander. Now, it's interesting that the Lutherans hated the Copernican system. It's amazing. So how did this happen? Although this story only emerged gradually, it seems that Osander took it upon himself to write an unsigned preface saying that Copernicus's ideas were in no way intended to describe reality. They were simply a mathematical model to help with calculations. Osander even changed the title to make it sound less definitive. Osander was clearly worried about how people would react to Copernicus's revolutionary ideas. When Copernicus discovered this, he was livid, scrawling in huge red cross across the preface and his copy of the book. What Copernicus thought about all this, no one quite knows, but therefore he died of a stroke shortly after the publication of the new book in 1543. He said that he had the new book for the first time when he briefly recovered consciousness, and that he died with it in his hands. One cannot but hope the story is true. It is interesting that Lutherans had major problems with Copernicus moving the Earth. It's not clear whether Sander's preface to De Revolutionibus succeeded in limiting the outrage that might have been caused by Copernicus's idea. The plain fact is that few people took much notice of it at first. Many of the original edition of 400 copies were left unsold, and there was certainly no clamour for the Catholic Church for Copernicus to be buried and burned at the stake. In fact, the only protest came from the Protestants Sander had tried to appease in this preface. It seems likely that few people appreciated the real implication of Copernicus's ideas at first. Those who did understand them often remained quiet about it and made no fusses made. One of those who did understand Copernicus was the English astronomer Thomas Digges. I love Thomas Digges. He's real fantastic. Who wrote the first explanation of the Copernican system in English in 1576. Digges actually went further than Copernicus, suggesting that the universe around the solar system was infinite and a multitude of stars in all directions. That is really fantastic. John Digges, a friend of Shakespeare and of Bruno. The famous Danish astronomer Tycho Brahe, 1546-1601, did not accept Copernicus' model himself, yet his meticulous observations slowly built up evidence in favour of it, not the least of which was his observation of a new star or supernova in 1572, which showed the stars were not imperfect, unchanging after all, whatever the Church and Ptolemy said. Well, yeah, I think it's more with Digges. And one of the reasons why Bray could not accept Copernicus' model was because he was a very precise observer. Copernicus' model did not precisely fit the facts. This is where Bray's assistant, Johann Kepler, 1571-1630, comes in. Unlike Bray, Kepler did accept the Copernican model, and what is more, a brilliant feat of mathematical inspiration, he found that a way to make it fit the facts using Bray's observations. If the orbits of the planets were elliptical, not circular, Kepler realized, then Copernican's system fits the facts perfectly. Well, that's okay, but then when Kepler wrote his to Galileo, he was just told to bugger off. It must be circles. Kepler's idea was finally published in full in 1619 in his book Harmonia Mundi, Harmony of the World, but by that time another astronomer, Gordiana Bruno, had been burned at the stake. Well, she was, because Bruno was Copernican and because Digges believed in a universe filled with infinite stars, people assumed he was burned for his dangerous astronomical ideas. In fact, he was condemned for Inquisition for blasphemous Arian beliefs and his practice of magic. Well, this is actually true. So your New South Wales textbooks say he's burned for Copernican ideas, but he was actually a complete right nor now his Aryan beliefs, the beliefs when Santa hit the Aryans, it started off Muslims. I really want to know what an Aryan belief is. All the same, the Catholic Church began to assess Copernicanism with the widespread threat of the Protestant Reformation. In 1610, Galileo saw his telescope the clinching evidence that Copernicus thought was right. Moon circling Jupiter, moon-like phases of Venus, as Galileo began to publicize the idea right from the heart of Catholic Europe. In Florence, the Church finally decided to take action. This again, not true. This, unfortunately, is not true. In 1660, 73 years after the first publication, they banned De Revolutionibus. That same year, the cardinals summoned Galileo to Rome and forbade him to talk about Copernicanism. Galileo persisted, and in the end, the cardinals had to threaten him with torture to shut him up. That's actually not true. It's so not true. But, of course, the battle was lost. Copernicus' revolution was in full swing all over Europe. However, it would take another 200 years before the Catholic Church lifted its ban on De Revolutionibus. The problem is that bans are far harder to lift, and it's not a slick modern system, the Catholic Church. Yeah, and there's a whole lot of politics. Okay, here's another person, 1514 to 1564, a little bit much, that's only 50 years of life. And Andreas Vesalius, I don't know, I've never heard of him before. Nothing is closer to us than our bodies, yet it took as long to explore the human body as it did the earth. Andreas Vesalius was perhaps the greatest body explorer of all, and in his book De Humi Corpus Fabrica, was the greatest landmark in the discovery of human anatomy. Until the time of Vesalius in the early 16th century, knowledge of the human body was based essentially on blind faith and guesswork. Direct observation played little part at all. Remarkably, medical students of Vesalius' times learned human anatomy not by studying bodies but by reading the works of Roman physician Galen. Students who went to lectures where corpses were dissected by barbers, basically a man with a sharp knife, even this was an innovation, but never themselves dissecting, preferring to read from Galen's work while the barber sliced away at a distance. There is no doubt that Galen had been a great authority. In his time, he was a wonderful physician, perhaps the most skilled of the ancient world, but his real knowledge of anatomy was shaky at best. Yet, such was the influence of his work that it was never questioned until Vesalius' day. One of the problems was it was taboo to dissect human bodies. A 14th century Bologna doctor called Bondo de Zuzzi was one of the first to carry out dissections, yet it was the first to hold Galen's work on him, and de Zuzzi's generally failed to see what must have been staring him in the face and simply compounded Galen's errors. What was remarkable about Vesalius is that he broke two taboos. First of all, he dared to challenge the 1,300-year-old authority of Galen. Secondly, he, by actually dissecting human bodies, looking at real anatomy closely, encouraging students to do the same. All the anatomical knowledge he gained in this way was put to great book Fabrica, which laid the foundations for modern medicines. Young Vesalius. He was born of the Flemish family in Brussels in 1514. His father had been a court official in the service of the Holy Roman Emperor. And so his grandfather, and it was an ambition to emulate them. There is no doubt the Andreas was an extremely driven, determined young man. As a teenager, he began medical studies at Leuven University in Brussels, and his fanatical desire to study anatomy was already evidenced. At 16, he was already stealing corpses for dissection from the gibbets in the middle of the night, and he soon began to ask judges to set dates for executions to days suitable for his work. Who was it? Napoleon said the Holy Roman Empire was neither Holy Roman nor Empire. Okay, so I've just got to get this. So he was one of the people who used to steal bodies at night. It's interesting. Before long, his pursuit of corpses was becoming positively gruesome. I think I remember reading about him. In 1533, he went to study in Paris, where he was often out at scouring graveyards for fresh bodies, or scavenging the poor burial sites, where he would fight with wild dogs over a body. Extraordinarily, to avoid unwanted attention, he took the bodies back to his bedroom and secretly dissected them there. Night after night, he would sleep with a rotting, partially dissected corpse beside him. And since he kept corpses for several weeks, the stench must have been truly appalling. But his obsessive pursuit of anatomical knowledge is paying off. While at Paris, his skill became to the attention of Jacob Sylvius and John Gualtier, the two great anatomists of Europe, both of whom were teaching at the university. I remember that they really hated what he had to say. Just a year later, at the age of 23, he was the head of the Department of Surgery and Anatomy at the University of Padua in Italy, then the most prestigious medical school in the world. Vesalius, like all doctors of the time, was still reading and learning Galen, but he abandoned the age-old practice of reading to students while the barber dissected the corpse, opting instead to perform the dissection himself while describing his students exactly what he was uncovering. Vesalius insisted that to know the human body, you must dissect it. This in itself was revolutionary enough, but of course Vesalius was also beginning to discover that Galen was not always right. In 1538, Vesalius got John Steffes of Calca, an artist in Titian studios, to draw dissections of six of the car charts he had been sketching to his students. Published as Tablet Atomicale 6, six anatomical charts, three of these charts show views of the human skeleton, while the other three show portal veins near the heart, at the heart and all the body's veins, the heart and all the arteries. This was a tremendous novelty. Few anatomical works before had ever illustrated. Vesalius' mentor, Sylvius, was annoyed, feeling that such illustrations would mislead students and degrade scholarship. Worse still, Vesalius' charts connected some small but important errors, corrected some small but important errors of Galen. This is interesting, your age-old conflict of knowledge systems. Despite the opposition it provoked, and the tablet was still an instant hit with students, Vesalius' reputation as an anatomist began to grow, as did his knowledge of human anatomy. Fired by the success of the tablet, he embarked on a huge groundbreaking project to create the first comprehensive, accurate, illustrated guide to the human anatomy based on dissection. Working with a brilliant team of artists, which may have included John Stephanus, Vesalius laboured for 4 years to produce a masterwork. When everything was finally prepared, he sent this manuscript across the Alps to Basel to John Orphus, a distinguished professor and a wonderful painter, who was to print the book on the finest paper and with the best typography. So concerned was Vesalius that his book should be the best quality of the high and accurate that he himself rode over the mountains to Basel and stayed there to oversee the printing personally. In the summer of 1543, Vesalius was still just 29. The human corpus fabrica was finished. He sent a magnificent purple silk-bound presentation to the Emperor Charles V, complete with 200 fabulously hand-coloured illustrations. The Emperor was so impressed that within a few months later, Vesalius was invited to become one of Charles' personal physicians. And this is interesting, medicine and sickness of royals. Within less than a year, Vesalius' burning thirst for knowledge seems to have evaporated. He abandoned academic career entirely. Having achieved his ambition to become a court official, he settled down to a distinguished but conservative career, marrying a Brussels girl's Anne von Ham. A couple had a child the next year who was named Anne von Ham, or Anne, whatever it is. Vesalius later implied that his decision to ban research in academia was partly due to the stream of vicious criticism he had received from publisher Fabrica, a criticism that he said that gnawed at my soul. Rather than face such attacks again, he would remain at court far from the sweet leisure of studies, and he would not consider publishing anything new, even if I wanted to do so very much. Yet he gave up research. There is no doubt that he became a highly distinguished physician esteemed across Europe. When Henry II of France was injured in the head of the lance in joust in 1559, Vesalius was summoned to Paris to help the court physicians who were trying all kinds of desperate measures to save the king. When Vesalius arrived, he examined Henry and was instantly certain that nothing could be done for him. Risking the French court's wrath, he announced the king would soon die. And 10 days later he did, despite all the efforts of Europe's best doctors. Vesalius was at the autopsy, which revealed that the lance blow had inflicted a massive damage to Henry's brain. 3 years later, Don Carlos, the Crown Prince of Spain, smashed his head, tumbling downstairs in his hurry to catch a glimpse of the caretaker's beautiful... Oh, dear. Beautiful daughter. Again, the younger prince's conditions deteriorated. Vesalius summoned for his expert advice. Arriving at Madrid, Vesalius took charge of the treatment. At first, Don Carlos seemed to grow even more ill, but Vesalius began to work, and after a few months, he was fully recovered. King Philip II was convinced that the cure came from the modified course of Fra Diego, a Francisco friar of the 13th century, which had been placed next to his the unconscious Don Carlos. But Vesalius' reputations could not have been higher. In 1564, Vesalius set out on a pilgrimage to the Holy Land. The reason for this is not known. One theory is that when dissecting a corpse of a young aristocrat in his Paduan day, he had been horrified to find the subject breathing, and the dissection had gone too far for Vesalius to save him. The tragedy had long haunted Vesalius, and the pilgrimage was perhaps penance for the ghastly mistake. Whatever the truth, Vesalius never returned, dying on the ship on his way home from Jerusalem. Vesalius Fabrica. Vesalius Fabrica is, without doubt, the greatest medical book ever produced until that time. It was an impressive size, 42 centimetres tall and 28 centimetres wide, i.e. the size of this bloody book. And it had 700 densely packed pages. It was a beautiful book. Its 200 illustrations were not merely the first complete collection of accurate anatomical drawings ever done, but were so artistic creations of the highest orders. The skulls were not just flat representation of bones, but magnificently posed and presented pictures. But it was neither the beauty or quality of the book that were the most remarkable aspects. What Fabrica milestone in scientific history was its mercilessly stark accuracy and representation of the human body flailed open in dissections that not the least corner was left hidden. Never before was the workings of the human body been represented so precisely. It was by no means flawless in its accuracy. And three of this prodigies, Gabriel Falloppio, Bartholomew, and Manuel Colombo very quickly made major new anatomical discoveries. But it was right on all the major details, a remarkable achievement after thousands of years of vagueness. Just how innovative Fabrica was, in particular, and its emphasis on dissection, can be gauged by the savagery of some of the criticism received. Remarkably, some of the most stinging comments came from Jacob Silvius versus Mentor at Paris. In an open letter to the Emperor Charles I, Silvius wrote, "I implore his imperial majesty to punish severely as he deserves the monster born and bred in his own house. The worst example of ignorance, ingratitude, arrogance, impropriety to suppress him so that he may not poison the rest of Europe with his pestilential breath." And one has to take a step back and recognise that this sort of thing is sort of like is an artifact of personal and other things come to focus on it. In spite of Vesalius' work, despite such criticism, Fabrica was an immediate and huge success. Within a decade, any medical student worth his salt would be learning anatomy not just from Vesalius' book, but by dissecting his corpses himself. Inspired by Vesalius' work, other physicians began to make their own dissections, gradually filling up the gaps in our knowledge of human anatomy. They began to learn about physiology too, and within a century, understanding the human body and how it works had advanced to an extraordinary degree. the foundations were laid, a remarkably detailed picture that we take for granted today. So that's his. So he's a bit of a creep, if you ask him. But it's also really interesting to see how he's handled them. The full title of Vassalis's book was De Humini Corpus Fabrica Libri Septem, for it was actually constructed in 7 volumes, Libri Septem. Book 1 reveals Vassalis's understanding of the importance of the skeleton. Before Vassalis, no one had grasped just how important bones are in terms of giving shape to the body's movement. However, he gave over the whole book 1 to bones, all drawn with wonderful details, and the book extends with a full 3 pages drawing to complete skeleton adopting different poses, including one suspended from a giblet and the other leaning on a desk studying anatomy. Book 2 is about muscles. The drawings, the volume is superb in book 1. Book 3 to 7 are less spectacularly beautiful, but still finely illustrated. Book 3 is about veins and arteries. Book 4, the nervous system. Book 5, about main body organs. 6, about the heart and lungs. Book 7, about the brain. At the same time Fabrica was published, so was the compact single-volume version of Epitome. Epitome contained many of Fabrica's famous drawings, but it was designed to be carried to the dissecting table by medical students, reinforcing the message of intensely practical dissection-based approach. That's nice. And I think Epitome was also the criticism of Ptolemy. Are you going now, Rupi? Are you able to walk yourself? Bye-bye. Okay, that's enough for this one, and I'll go on from there.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.